The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Friday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. James Blind is producing today's program, Clark Hilton Engineering. Dan Rice, he's given up his office for the sake of the cause. Today we're going to share an interview of the week. My guest was Roger J. Hutchinson. He's the author of The Death of Hitler, What Really Happened. It's a great fast, easy summer read, but very interesting in providing facts from all over the globe. That's coming up in the second hour of today's program. We're also going to take a look at the lighter side of the news. We'll cover that in the first hour of today's program, right after these headline news stories. Well, Connecticut U.S. Attorney John Durham's investigation into the origins of the Russia probe will see a development on Friday. That's what was said earlier today by Secretary Barr, with more significant developments to come, the Attorney General said in an exclusive interview. While Friday's news won't be earth-shattering, he said, it would be an indication that things are moving along at a proper pace, as dictated by the facts in this investigation. There are two different things going on. The American people need to know what actually happened in 2016-17, and moving forward, that will be done. Well, the second aspect, he said, is this. If people cross the line, if people involved in that activity violated criminal law, they will be charged. And John Durham is an independent man, highly experienced, and his investigation is pursuing apace. There was some delay because of COVID-19, but he went on to say, I'm satisfied with the progress. And I've said there are going to be developments, significant developments before the election, end quote. He went on to say that we're not doing this on the election schedule. We're aware of the election. We're not going to do anything inappropriate before the election, but we're not being dictated to by that schedule. He added the timing of the disclosures will be determined by the developments in the case. In other developments, the Attorney General warned Democrats they're playing with fire over the mail-in voting push. Michael Cohen offered a preview of the tell-all Trump book saying, I know where the skeletons are buried, and Portland will now allow police officers to interact with some federal authorities. The Oregon State Police are no longer protecting the federal courthouse that have been at the center of riots, and Portland officials are still cleaning tear gas residue and toxins from streets. The Kentucky AG met with Breonna Taylor's family for the first time 5 months after her untimely death, and the Austin City Council is voting to cut $150 million from its police budget. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton is ready to help the Biden administration, if asked, speaking at the 19th Represents Summit. That was on Thursday. Hillary Clinton says she'd be willing to serve if Joe Biden wins the 2020 election. I'm ready to help in any way I can, she said when she was asked if she would accept a job in his administration. Because I think this will be a moment where every American, I don't care what party you are, I don't care what age, race, gender, I don't care, every American should want to fix our country, she said. So if you're asked to serve, you should certainly consider that. Well, Clinton previously served alongside Joe Biden in the Obama administration as Secretary of State. Republicans were critical about her tenure as the at the department, including her handling of the 2012 Benghazi terrorist attack and the private email server controversy that plagued her 2016 presidential campaign. Clinton had offered her endorsement of the former vice president earlier this year. Also earlier this week, she expressed her overwhelming approval of Senator Kamala Harris, Biden's running mate. I'm thrilled to welcome Kamala Harris to a historic Democrat ticket, Clinton tweeted. She's already proven herself to be an incredible public servant and leader, and I know she'll be a strong partner to Joe Biden. Please join me in having her back and getting her elected. Clinton is scheduled, by the way, to speak next week at the DNC convention. Meanwhile, progressives are blasting the DNC for only giving AOC 60 seconds at the convention, and they're pre-recorded. And an Iranian fuel was confiscated by U.S. officials. The United States Postal Service will award a $6.3 billion contract for new mail trucks, and Apple and Google are at war with Epic Games over the popular video game. American Airlines, they're planning to cut out some stops. Well, CDC says that more than one in four young adults seriously considered suicide in this past month, attributed directly to the pandemic and the impact of physical distancing and stay-at-home orders. Another story notes the data also flags a surge of anxiety and substance abuse, with more than 40% of those surveyed saying they experienced a mental or behavioral health condition connected to the COVID-19 emergency. Josh Krauschauer points out that this is a stunning figure, one that underscores concerns that shutdowns can create their own health crises. The Trump administration announced an historic peace agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. From the story, President Trump's Mideast strategy has been to strongly back Israel, support the Gulf monarchies, and press back hard against Iranian imperialism. His liberal critics insisted this would lead to catastrophe that never came, and on Thursday, it delivered a diplomatic achievement. The United Arab Emirates and Israel agreed to normalize relations, making the UAE the first Arab League country to recognize the Jewish state in 20 years. In other news, the Department of Justice ruled that Yale does, in fact, discriminate against Asians. The agency said a two-year investigation into the Ivy League school found that Asian and white applicants have one-tenth of a one-fourth the chance of being admitted as African-American applicants with the same credentials. A poll from last year showed 73% of Americans believe race should not be a factor in college admissions. This was also true of 62% of African Americans. Yale has announced they will continue to break the law. Well, a Seattle mob is going through neighborhoods threatening residents there. The words they used were vulgar. One group was actually chanting, "Who do we protect? Black criminals." Well, the mayor of Seattle is trying to get the state Supreme Court to stop a recall effort because she has been ineffectual at stopping such assaults. Soccer fans booed as a team took to the knee during the national anthem, with one soccer player complaining they don't understand what kneeling means. The problem is the fans do understand, and they booed. Mark Davis points out, more of this, please. Athletes in every sport must be shown how forgettable they are. They will quickly become if they insist on resisting with gestures such as this. Some are willing to pay that price. Well, a five-year-old boy was assassinated while riding his bike, but the media has completely ignored the story because the races aren't right. It was an African-American who shot the young boy point blank. Maine University wants students to sign a Black Lives Matter statement pledging anti-racism behaviors. It's already been declared unconstitutional by a constitutional lawyer. Nancy Pelosi says there will be no coronavirus relief talks until Republicans agree to a massive $2 trillion price tag. Mitch McConnell announced the Senate will adjourn until September 8th unless a stimulus bill is struck. And President Trump plans to deliver his Republican National Convention speak on the White House lawn. Joe Biden is calling for a nationwide mask mandate. Every single American should be wearing a mask when they're outside, he said. And Dr. Anthony Fauci says there is no reason why we shouldn't be able to vote in person. Oregon State Police have pulled out of protecting Portland's courthouse after the city refused to prosecute criminal behavior. And a UC Berkeley study finds that at least 15,800 essential workers would not have contracted COVID if California had stockpiled enough masks and PPE. 13 states are making contact tracing data public. And temporary layoffs are becoming permanent job losses as 62% of employers don't plan to rehire. Saying that only the Supreme Court can revise its precedent, Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upholds a male-only military draft. The NSA and FBI have exposed Russian intelligence, a hacking tool, and Non Copus Mentis, the 9/11 Tribute in Light Memorial in New York City, has been canceled, supposedly over COVID-19 concerns. Georgia's governor plans to drop the lawsuit over Atlanta's mask mandate. And an FBI lawyer has pled guilty to falsifying documents for Carter Page in the FISA warrant. Former FBI lawyer Kevin Kleinsmith has pled guilty to falsifying the document used to obtain a FISA warrant on former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. Kleinsmith will be charged in Washington with one felony count of making a false statement and will plead guilty in a plea deal with the prosecutors conducting a criminal probe of the Russia investigation. The probe is being led by Prosecutor John Durham, who was appointed to the task by Attorney General William Barr. Barr hinted at a development in the Durham probe in comments earlier in the week. It's not an earth-shattering development, but it's an indication that things are moving along. Kleinsmith is set to admit that he altered an email from the CIA in order to renew the FISA warrant against Page in 2017. A report by the Justice Department Inspector General found numerous inaccuracies in the FBI's applications to surveil Page. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with some of the lighter side of the news.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. On Fridays, we like to take a look at some of the lighter side of the news. To join me to do just that is James Blend, who is producing today's program from a remote location somewhere out there, as he and I are quarantined at separate locations. Yo, James.
How's it going? What, day 180 in the bunker yet or something? I don't know.
Somewhere around there. Well, I'd like to start the Friday fun with a, it could be worse. And today's It Could Be Worse story involves a boar, a swimming hole, and the Baltic Sea. It was a peaceful day on a German beach turned to chaos when a wild boar swam out of the Baltic Sea and ran loose through crowds of sunbathers. It could be worse. A video shared by the Seabed Warmbund Resort on Facebook shows the boar coming out of the sea at a crowded beach in Schoningen. I'm a little rusty on my German. Holstein, we'll just leave it at that. Well, the footage shows a man attempting to ward the wild pig away from the crowds with a shovel, but the undeterred boar ran through the beach, sending sunbathers running for safety. Witnesses said the boar eventually ran off down the coast to harass, I suppose, other sunbathers. The boar is believed to be the same animal earlier spotted swimming miles away off the coast of Lower Saxony. One sailor said that he and his colleagues were unable to guide the boar out of the water, and it was last seen swimming toward Schoningen, where it apparently popped up and terrified people. So if you're having a bad day, a tough week, tough quarantine, it could be worse. You could have an encounter with a boar while sunbathing along the Oregon coast.
See, I can't.
You feel better, James?
Well, a little bit, but for exciting as it is, you have to also realize it's kind of boring.
Well, it was that.
Yeah.
Well, there's a new oral hygiene issue. It's caused by, well, you guessed it, wearing a mask all the time to prevent the spread of coronavirus.
It's mask mouth.
Leading to all kinds of dental disasters like decaying teeth, receding gum lines, and seriously sour breath. Now, my guess is it's not the mask. It's that people are less diligent brushing their teeth, perhaps. Well, some bad breath just can't be covered up. Well, now that dentists have reopened their doors, they're having patients show up with a nasty set of symptoms, which the doctors have dubbed mask mouth. The new oral hygiene issue caused by, you guessed it, wearing a mask all the time to prevent the spread of the virus is leading to all kinds of issues. We're seeing inflammation in people's gums that have been healthy forever and cavities in people who have never had them before. A dentist and co-founder of One Manhattan Dental said about 50% of our patients are being impacted by this, so we've decided to name it mask mouth after meth mouth. The term meth mouth is widely used by dentists to describe the dental problems that arise among methamphetamine users. Addicts often end up with cracked black and brown stained teeth because the stimulant causes sugar cravings, teeth grinding, and jaw clenching. They also often neglect their oral hygiene. So all of this, the stress of the pandemic, as well as the neglect of oral hygiene, they're calling it mask mouth.
Yeah, I had my first experience with mask mouth about a month ago. It didn't even occur to me. We had gone out for dinner, and I had picked up food from an Italian place and ate outside, and very, very, very garlicky food, I might add, and glorious in that garlicness until you put the mask on. And then I was in a world of hurt. I was just like, oh, this is terrible.
Thankfully, you were offending yourself.
I was offending myself. I walked across the parking lot to a grocery store. I immediately went in and bought mints. I mean, it was one of those do not pass go, do not collect $200. Because if I didn't pass go, I was going to pass out. And it was just one of those things that, oh, my word, And it was instant. It was the first breath outward. It was like, oh, that's no wonder people don't want to be around me after Italian. Wow.
Well, I guess the moral of the story is practice good oral hygiene. If you're about to go out, make sure you brush your teeth, maybe right before you go and maybe right after you've returned. I feel bad for people who have to wear them for long periods of time. They're working in a grocery store or they're medical professionals. But oral hygiene might help somewhat, but don't be surprised if you encounter mask mouth.
Definitely well, an Israeli mints for your own well-being.
There you go. There you go. An Israeli jewelry company is working on what it says will be the world's most expensive coronavirus mask. It's a gold diamond encrusted face covering with a price tag of $1.5 million. My guess is because there's no ventilation in that thing, you're probably going to have a pretty severe case of mask mouth. This 18 karat white gold mask will be decorated with 3,600 white and black diamonds, fitted with top rated N99 filters at the request of the buyer, according to the designer. Mr. Isaac Levy, who's the owner of Yevil Company, said the buyer had two other demands, and apparently he already has a buyer, that it be completed by the end of the year and that it would be the priciest in the world. That last condition, he said, was the easiest to fulfill. He declined to identify the buyer, but said he was a Chinese businessman living in the United States. Well, the glitzed up mask, this face mask, may lend some pizzazz to the protective gear now mandatory in public spaces in many countries. But at 270 grams, over half a pound, nearly 100 times that of a typical surgical mask, it's not likely to be a practical accessory to wear. So look for the gold diamond encrusted face mask. You'll have to come up with a whole nother description for mask mouth for that thing.
What kind of mask mouth does that give you with, you know, so much less air filtration there? It's just going to keep all the moisture in, and ooh.
Yeah, it's not going
to
be.
Explain that to your dentist. Yes, I've got a $1 billion mask, but $10 mouth.
And a $3 smile.
Yep.
Well, you know, a lot of people are really struggling with boredom and, you know, other elements of depression and anxiety during this season, and they find themselves standing in front of their refrigerator for no good reason. Well, I wanted to give you one good reason to or one way to explain the fallout from such behavior. There was a Chinese man whose big belly actually saved him from falling down a well. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we don't have any wells in the ground in this this part of the world, but you can always use that as an excuse. I am bulking up in the event that I find myself trapped in a well. Well, rescuers in Hainan province credited his weight with helping to save him. He's got real guts, they said. Well, an overweight Chinese man found his belly to be a lifesaver after it got wedged in this well and stopped him from falling down, according to officials. The 28-year-old, identified as Liu, he got trapped in his family's well after breaking through wood that had been used to cover it in his hometown in Hainan province. Now, I guess you could look at this two ways. If he hadn't been so heavy, he wouldn't have broken through the cover of the well. But since he was as heavy as he is, he was prevented from going down the well. So I guess you could look at it two ways. An official fire service video clip shared on social media showed rescuers arriving late Friday as the shirtless man patiently waited with his arms crossed. He remained that way in rather gobsmacked, as the Brits say, as locals watched as the team took at least five firefighters rather, to try a strong rope around his waist to finally heave him out to safety, totally unharmed, but perhaps a bit humiliated. By the way, the fire service had estimated the man weighed about 500 pounds, although the Sun cited other reports that he was closer to 300. In the event, I'm bulking up in the event that I fall through a well. Works for me. I'm going to go get a sandwich. An Italian basketball freestyler tied a Guinness World Record when he launched himself from a trampoline to do a front flip slam dunk from 26 feet, 6.89 inches away. Well, Mr. David Rizzi, he appeared on the Guinness TV special La Nota da Something Something Else in Rome. He failed to reach the hoop on his initial attempt at the record, but on his second attempt, he managed to dunk the ball into the hoop. Guinness required that he touch the rim in dunking the ball for it to qualify for the record. His distance was measured at 26 feet, 6.89 inches, tying the record previously held by someone else who had way, way too much time on their hands, setting the record straight. As if 2020 wasn't weird enough, and it certainly is weird enough, Dunkin' is getting into the cereal business. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll tell you more about it. You may be interested in something new on your breakfast table, you know, while you're bulking up to avoid falling into a well. Hey, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show, looking at some of the lighter side of the news. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. In the second hour of today's program, we'll share our interview of the week. My guest was Robert Hutchinson, author of The Death of Hitler, What Really Happened. The book is published by Regnery History. You can enjoy that conversation in the second hour of the Georgene Rice Show. James Blind has joined me as we're taking a look at some of the lighter side of the news from the last this past week. Well, 2020 has certainly been a weird year, and Dunkin' Donuts is contributing to that whole scheme. They're getting into the cereal game. They're Massachusetts-based. They're a coffee and donuts empire. They're releasing two new breakfast cereals, and they're based on two of its most popular coffee drinks, caramel macchiato and mocha latte. Now, how many adults are going to eat this? You know, cereal, especially the sugary ones, are most appealing to children. But how many kids, and for that matter, how many adults are going to want to have caramel macchiato cereal and mocha latte? Well, the team up with Post Consumer Brands, the makers of Honey Bunches of Oats, Shredded Wheat, Raisin Bran, other familiar cereals, is expected to hit grocery shelves later this month. So keep your eyes open. The companies say Dunkin's Coffee Concentrate is added to the cereal, which consists of little crunchy spheres mixed with flavored marshmallow bits. There's no marshmallow in coffee. A serving that has about as much caffeine as a tenth of an 8-ounce cup of coffee. Reaction on social media has ranged from enthusiastic anticipation to horrified yet intrigued. Skeptics, and there are many of them, see another sign of the apocalypse, while others see redemption from an otherwise dreadful year. I love to pretend like I'm not a diehard New Englander, but if I don't get to try the Dunkin' Donuts cereal, I will absolutely lose my mind, said one Twitter user. Still others see a marketing opportunity missed. A 10-year-old girl who recently taste-tested the cereal for the Boston Globe suggested they should make a donut-flavored cereal. I mean, that seems pretty obvious. To be sure, the donut chain did try just that. It launched a cereal line based on their popular glazed and chocolate donuts in the 80s. It didn't exactly take off, but the company's interest is in trying to break into the market again is understandable. Nearly 65% of American adults drink coffee every day, and nearly 90% of U.S. households consume cereal, according to Dunkin'. The cereal efforts comes as Dunkin's brick-and-mortar shops, like other nationwide shops, have taken a hit during the coronavirus pandemic. The company recently announced plans to close roughly 800 U.S. stores this year, or about 8% of its U.S. locations. So are you excited about this coffee-flavored cereal, caramel macchiato and mocha latte?
I don't like coffee on a normal day, so no, I'm not really into that. But I could go for it. I mean, I don't really called the cereal in the 80s. There were a lot of a lot of different varieties of cereals back in the 80s. You name the movie, it had a cereal, it seemed like. Yeah. I wouldn't mind a cereal that was maybe donut shaped. Maybe some of them would be like whole wheat and some of them could be glazed and some of them maybe a bit of apple and cinnamon away.
Yeah, we got that.
Yeah, there you go.
The caramel macchiato? Now there's something new.
I'll stick with the Apple Jacks.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, chihuahuas, what are they good for? They're essentially small rats with long legs. But one chihuahua saved its owner's life during a stroke on a houseboat. Now, this sounds like the start of a good joke, but a North Carolina man was reunited with his beloved dog 5 days after the chihuahua was credited with saving his life during a stroke. Now, we are mostly familiar with Lassie. He's a border collie, and the dog does all kinds of wonderful things. Well, this 86-year-old Rudy Armstrong, a Navy veteran who lives alone on a houseboat in Oriental with his dog Boo Boo, said he realized he was having a stroke on the boat and he couldn't reach his phone because he was unable to move one of his arms and one of his legs. I didn't want to be there for a couple of days before somebody would come by, he said, speaking to local media. So I said, okay, Boo Boo, go get me some help. Wow, I can see the scene right now. Well, Boo Boo the Chihuahua ran off at her owner's urging and returned a short time later. Now, short time would have to be defined because Chihuahuas can move at about, what, an inch of 5 minutes? They've got these little tiny rat-like legs. Anyway, a short time later with Doc Master, who summoned paramedics to the scene, Armstrong said he believes that Boo Boo the Chihuahua saved his life by following his instructions. He was hospitalized, the man, not the dog, and was reunited with his dog 5 days later. I've got tears running out of my eyes, said the owner during a reunion. I missed her so much. Wow, isn't that a touching story?
That is absolutely weird.
I mean, how did the Chihuahua get the door open? That's what I want to know. Well, a Virginia animal shelter said a cat named Dennis Quaid will soon be on his way to a new happy home with actor Dennis Quaid. Yeah. The Far From Heaven actor said he happened to see a WSLS TV story about a cat that shares his name at the Lynchburg Humane Society and decided he had to give the feline a home. Well, not just a home, his home. It was really off the wall, but I just couldn't resist, said Quaid. I had to get it. I'm out to save all the Dennis Quaids of the world, he says. The actor said he recently launched a pet-themed podcast with Jimmy Jelinek and Dennis Quaid, and the cat will have a new home at the office they share. Now, my guess is Dennis Quaid probably will never touch the cat. He's got people to do that. But maybe they should start naming animals and shelters after different celebrities and see who bites, Quaid said. Danielle Ulmer, who's the adoption agency manager for Lynchburg Humane Society, said staff were initially in disbelief. I was like, there's no way. There's no way this is real. Like, someone is pranking us, Ulmer said. I always chuckle when they say it was like. Well, was it or was it just like? Anyway, Jelinek is planning to fly to Virginia from Los Angeles during the upcoming weekend to bring Dennis Quaid the cat to Dennis Quaid the man. Again, very touching story.
Wow, if I'm Dennis Quaid, I'm thinking, cat, awesome. Not. But it's probably based on the last couple movies he's made. This may be the most publicity he's gotten in a few years.
That could certainly be. Well, Michigan state officials said a drone mapping shoreline erosion in the Upper Peninsula was sent to a watery grave in a brazen attack by a bald eagle. The Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy, or EAGLE, E-G-L-E, said the drone was being piloted by environmental quality analyst Hunter King along the Lake Michigan shore when it encountered the bird of prey near someplace. Well, King said he was watching the video feed from the drone when it started spinning like a really bad roller coaster ride. The analyst said he looked up in the sky and noticed the drone was gone and a bald eagle was flying away from the scene. A couple of bird watching folks nearby told King that they had seen the eagle knock the unmanned aircraft out of the sky. Unrivaled, the eagle, the one spelled with an A. Multiple searches of the area were unable to locate the fallen drone. Eagle said, that's E-G-L-E, the drone. It will be replaced with a similar model. The department joked the drone was sent to a watery grave in the brazen attack. Eagle said the officials contacted the Michigan Department of Natural Resources to see if it might issue a citation, a violation notice to the rogue eagle. Unfortunately, there's nothing we can do, they said. Nature is a cruel and unforgiving mistress. I would like to have seen that takedown. That would have to have been pretty exciting to watch.
That would have been fun. Way more fun than Dennis Quaid the cat.
Mississippi's Flag Commission said a proposed state flag bearing the image of a giant mosquito has been removed from the shortlist and was only included due to a typo. Well, the Mississippi Department of Archives and History said the mosquito flag, a variation on a popular hospitality flag design with a giant mosquito inside a circle of stars instead of large star, was never meant to be one of the 147 design in round two of the flag selection. The department said the flag was initially included in the gallery as a result of a typo in a list of flag numbers submitted by the Flag Commission. Well, the hospitality flag was notably absent from the round two gallery, said one participant, because its designer did not want it to be in the running. Well, the Flag Commission is expected to choose a final design next month, and voters will then decide in November if the flag will be adopted as the state's new symbol. I thought the mosquito was a great idea. If the vote is unsuccessful, a new selection process will begin, and another vote will be taken in November of 2021, if we should all live so long. The mosquito flag. Hey, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We need to take a quick break. When we return, we'll let you know about the latest sighting of a murder hornet trapped somewhere, perhaps not too far from here. More on that when we return. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show on a fun Friday afternoon.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. is aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show on a Friday afternoon. We're taking a look at the lighter side of the news. I say we because James Blind has joined me for these segments. Coming up later in the second hour of today's program, we'll hear from Robert Hutchinson, author of The Death of Hitler, What Really Happened. It's part of the series, the What Really Happened series. In fact, the title is actually the reverse, What Really Happened, The Death of Hitler. Anyway, Mr. Hutchinson will join us in the 5 o'clock hour after top of the hour news. Well, nearly 4 months after the murder hornet first appeared in the United States, researchers at the Washington State Department of Agriculture have trapped the irate insect for the first time in our sister state, Washington. Scientifically known as the Asian giant hornet, which is bad enough, this enormous hornet was captured on the 14th of July in a trap. It was positively identified, becoming the first hornet to be detected in a trap as opposed to the wild, according to the release by the government agency in Washington, the Department of Agriculture. This is encouraging because it means we know that the traps are working, said Sven Spikiger. He's the managing entomologist for the department in a release. But it also means we have work to do. Now, it's not clear at this time if the Asian giant hornet that was captured is a worker or a queen, given its size, with Spikiger's telling the media during the conference call that the additional research is needed. The next step, they say, will take looking for nests using infrared cameras to place additional traps. So far, more than 1,300 traps have been set in the state of Washington, as well as citizen scientists and other corporations. Special traps will be set to keep the giant hornets alive, according to the WSDA pest program. They want to attempt to tag and track them back to their colony. Once the colony is found, the agency will attempt to get rid of it. So this is search and destroy mission. I would love to see the murder hornet and the eagle that we spoke about in the last segment in a face-off. But
that sounds like a pay-per-view special. I'd pay to stream that.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I think that's certainly more interesting than anything on, like, Shark Week or something.
Well, a Colorado woman lived out a childhood fear last week after she leaned over her apartment toilet bowl and saw a 4-foot corn snake slither out. I'm not sure how common that is in Colorado, but Miranda Stewart from Fort Collins says she got a rude awakening when she investigated why her toilet wouldn't flush. Now, I'm wondering, I don't even really want to go through the mechanics of this. I looked and leaned in closer and a snake head slithered up, she says. I was terrified. It actually been one of my fears since I was a kid. And I have to admit, this is something I think about from time to time. She and her boyfriend call their apartment complex maintenance man to help unclog the snake from the toilet. They shot a 9-minute long video from inside the bathroom showing the man take the toilet apart to wrangle the snake, which coiled up inside. It took the maintenance man nearly 40 minutes to finally free the snake, the station reported. It's not clear how the snake ended up in the pipes and slithered into their toilet. They believe it may have been the pet of another tenant in the apartment complex and escaped through their toilet in the other room. After their unsuccessful search for the snake's possible owner, they decided to adopt the serpent. Oh my. I took him home and my wife was very happy with me and we named him Boots. He said, he's our little guardian snake on our property. Now, this is the maintenance man and not the woman, Miranda Stewart, who actually found the snake upon attempting to flush, which tells me the snake was there while she was there. I'll just leave it at that. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to take a minute just to... Ugh.
Yeah, no, that's rough. That's rough,
yeah,
right there.
Let's leave it at that. Well, a Tennessee woman was left surprised and confused when she received her new driver's license. Now, if I ended there, no one would be surprised. Dan Rice recently had to go and have his driver's license renewed, which meant the picture. And, you know, Dan Rice is a good-looking guy. You would not know that from the picture on his driver's license. Well, this Tennessee woman had to go back because when she received her new license, well, it left her surprised. Well, you receive them in the mail now, and she noticed something was missing in her photo. And the answer in her case was herself. Well, Jade Dodd said that her renewed license didn't have her picture on it. When the ID card arrived in the mail, she quickly noticed it bore a photo of an empty chair where her face should have been. She said she visited the Department of Motor Vehicles office to get the error corrected. And the lady at the DMV did not really believe me when I said, hey, I need my license fixed. Then she looked it up in the system and goes, oh, I need my manager for this. Well, one would hope so. The DMV spokesman said the error resulted from the wrong photo being saved to the profile. When the customer recently renewed her driver's license online, she received an image of a chair because that was the last picture taken on file. When the department was made aware of the situation, they immediately made things right with the consumer and provided her with a license with her actual photo and have addressed the situation internally. Dodd, the license holder, said she finds the situation rather funny and a much needed bit of levity amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, good for her. She chose to laugh rather than weep bitterly over the situation.
I think we all need to laugh sometimes.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, the mother of a baby born on an airline that was taking her to a hospital in Anchorage has named her son, who was born on the airline, Sky. Well, because of his unique birth and first experience. Crystal Hicks gave birth to Sky Hicks on the 5th of August at about 1 a.m. after boarding a plane to be flown from the small community of Glenallen to a hospital. She was 35 weeks pregnant. I was just having contractions and it wouldn't stop and it kept getting stronger and they thought we were going to make it, but of course they didn't. Hicks gave birth less than an hour into the flight. It was shocking, really weird at first. I didn't know what to think, she says, but everybody kept talking about the baby on the plane and that helped calm her down. She and her son made it safely to the hospital. She was placed on a breathing machine when she arrived because he was born on a month premature, I should say. The baby is expected to be discharged from hospital soon. Hicks has said filling out the birth certificate information was different because they were some 18,000 feet in the air. I just put Anchorage, she says. I didn't want to put on a plane or in the sky. Hicks has three other children, 3, 9, and 11, so she didn't panic through this whole ordeal. Well, there's one end of the life continuum. On the other end, a Michigan woman, she celebrated her 103rd birthday and being sprung from lockdown at a nursing home by trying something new, getting her first tattoo. Dorothy Pollock celebrated her 103rd birthday in COVID-19 lockdown at a Muskegon nursing home on the 16th of June, and her family said they soon realized they needed to get her back out into the world. Well, the nurse in the home said that she was horribly depressed and needed to get out. We couldn't see her, so we had no idea how she really was. She's extremely hard of hearing, so phone calls were not helpful, according to her granddaughter. And I feel so deeply for others who are in similar situations. Pollock celebrated her freedom on Friday by getting her first tattoo. It was a small frog on her arm. It was pretty exciting because years ago, my grandson wanted me to get one, and I wouldn't do it, she said. All of a sudden, I decided I would like to have one. And if I could, it would be a frog because, well, I like frogs. And at 103, you do not argue with grandma. If she wants a frog tattoo, she gets a frog tattoo. And I'm curious if there are challenges to tattooing someone whose skin is 103 years old, but she did it. It looks like a frog and she's happy and out of at least some level of quarantine. James, you thinking about getting a tattoo at 103?
Possibility is there if I actually last to 103, because you know it's with you for the rest of your life, but if the rest of your life's only 2 weeks, why not?
You might as well go for it. Well, a couple who came under attack for displaying the Norwegian flag outside their mid-Michigan inn because some observers mistook it for a Confederate flag and found another way to show their Scandinavian pride. You know, people know your flags, know the history. Greg and Kirsten Offenbecker, who own the Nordic Pineapple in St. John's outside Lansing, Michigan, took Norway's flag down last month after being accused of promoting racism, the Lansing State Journal reported. They're replacing it with a vimple, a type of long pennant-shaped flag that can be seen displaying various designs across Scandinavia. The Offenbecker's Vimple will have the colors of the Norwegian flag, a red background with blue cross superimposed on the white cross, in a nod to Kirsten Offenbecker's grandfather, who was born in Norway. Well, the colors of the Norwegian flag are similar to the Confederate flag, but the patterns and symbols are different. The Confederate flag is red with a blue X containing white stars. Well, after removing the Norwegian flag last month, people around the globe contacted them and urged them to put it back up. Many suggested different ways to display the flag. Someone in Norway suggested a vimple, which isn't an official national flag, but it's close enough. And now the Vimple flies over the inn, the Nordic Pineapple, in Lansing, Michigan.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the second hour of the Georgene Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. James Blind is producing today's program. Well, a federal appeals court on Friday overturned California's ban on high-capacity ammunition magazines, ruling that the prohibition violates the Second Amendment. Even well-intentioned laws must pass constitutional muster. Appellate Judge Kenneth Lee wrote for the majority on the three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, adding that California's ban strikes at the core of the Second Amendment, the right to armed self-defense. Well, California's ban on magazines holding more than 10 bullets is so sweeping that half of all magazines in America are now unlawful to own in California, Lee wrote. One of the judges on the panel dissented, leaving a majority of two who voted to throw out the ban, which Lee wrote was passed in the wake of the heart-wrenching and highly publicized mass shootings. Gun rights groups celebrated the ruling. California Rifle and Pistol Association attorney Chuck Michael hailed the decision as a huge victory for Americans who own firearms and the right to choose to own firearms to defend their family. My guess is that decision will be appealed to the full Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Well, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden is up 49% to 42% over President Donald Trump in a head-to-head matchup, according to a national Fox News survey of registered voters. 9% are undecided or back a third-party candidate. Since March of last year, Trump's support has stayed between 38% to 42%, and Biden's lead has been outside the poll margin of sampling error 16 points, or 16 times. At the same time, the Democrats' current 7-point lead is a bit lower than his 8-point advantage last month and 12-point lead in June. The poll was conducted Sunday through Wednesday, so over half of the interviews were completed before Tuesday's announcement of California Senator Kamala Harris as Biden's running mate. And President Trump would not reject a conspiracy theory Thursday that Kamala Harris is ineligible to serve as vice president because her parents were born outside the United States. Now, this has become quite a flap. And this is what the president actually said. Asked about the unfounded and widely refuted claims during a press briefing at the White House, the president responded, "I heard it today that she doesn't meet the requirements," before adding, "I have no idea if that's right." That's the controversy. Harris is a United States citizen, born in California in 64, making her eligible to serve as president or vice president under the Constitution. However, a professor of law at Chapman University, John Eastman, wrote a piece for Newsweek this week after she was named to the Democratic ticket, questioning whether Harris is a natural-born citizen because her mother was born in India and her father in Jamaica. Well, during the Thursday press briefing, Trump appeared to fuel the argument by touting the author's credentials, saying, "And by the way, the lawyer that wrote the piece is a very highly qualified, very talented lawyer," end quote. "I have no idea if that's right," he went on to say. "I would have assumed the Democrats would have checked that out before she gets chosen to run as vice president." The president then said, "You're saying that she doesn't qualify because she wasn't born in this country?" The reporter corrected the president to say Harris was born in the United States, but the issue involves the birthplace of her parents. Trump said, "I don't know about it. I just heard about it. I'll take a look." The fact that he didn't definitively say, "Oh, no, she's absolutely eligible," has now become quite a flap. And it was interesting today as I looked on Facebook to how people were posting this, the headlines. It made it sound like he went out of his way to undermine the credibility of her citizenship. It just was fascinating to watch how the story was distorted to the point where he was the originator of the controversy, that he was the one who was touting the controversy. Don't believe everything you read on Facebook, even though it may have been ripped from today's headlines. It was quite fascinating to see all in one short space of time. Trust in police has fallen below 50% for the first time in an annual Gallup poll. Military, they maintain their high level of support among Americans. Well, the late artist Norman Rockwell's evocation of the friendly, helpful neighborhood police officer defined law enforcement for millions of Americans when they were growing up. But that image no longer holds sway among a majority of people in the United States, according to a new Gallup poll. Well, over the past year, confidence in the police dropped to 48%, the first time it's been below a majority level in 27 years since the respected pollster has asked Americans their views about law enforcement. The fall from 53% last year comes amid nationwide protests, of course, against police brutality and systematic racism sparked by the death of George Floyd. Over the nearly three decades the poll has been asked about the police, the highest level of confidence in law enforcement had been at 64%. As with most subjects in the hyper-partisan era, Republicans and Democrats see the police differently. 82% of Republicans have confidence in law enforcement, an increase of 7 percentage points from last year. Gallup found only 28% of Democrats feel the same way, down 6 points. And while fewer Americans overall hold the police in high regard, the polls show that other U.S. institutions saw a surge in trust this year. These include organized religion, up 6 percentage points to 42%, and even banks, which jumped 8 points to 38%, bringing them almost back to the level of confidence they enjoyed before the 2008-2009 financial crisis. Well, the U.S. Postal Service announced that it plans to remove high-volume mail processing machines in hundreds of locations, sparking fears that it could reduce the ability to process mail during the election. Look at it this way. Your local grocery store was forced to cut a third of its cash-out lines, but management expected the same productivity, quality, and speed for the customer. And a worker at the Buffalo, Iowa USPS distributions facility in an interview said, this is a challenge for us. It's just never going to happen. Well, President Trump has vocally attacked voting by mail in recent weeks, claiming that the practice leads to mass fraud. He also openly stated on Thursday that he's starving the United States Postal Service of money to make it harder to process an expected surge of mail-in ballots, which he worries could cost him the election and, more importantly, could cost the election its credibility. USPS offers 671 said machines used to organize mail, which is to be reduced in dozens of cities over the coming months, according to CNN. The agency started removing machines back in June, according to postal workers. I'm not sure you're going to find an answer as to why the machines are being removed or that it makes sense, says one postal worker, President Kimberly Carroll, in an interview, because we haven't figured that out either. So we don't know why they're being removed or who called for it. Newly appointed Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has been a major donor to the president before taking over the sprawling mail service, said that the Postal Service has ample capacity to handle the predicted surge in mail-in ballots in the coming months. This organizational change will capture operating efficiencies by providing clarity and economics of scale that will allow us to reduce our cost base and capture new revenue. And of course, the Postal Service has been going bankrupt for, well, decades, perhaps. The Justice Department on Friday announced the U.S. government's largest ever seizure of fuel shipments from Iran in a successful disruption of a multi-million dollar shipment by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a designated foreign terrorist organization that was bound for Venezuela. The Justice Department on Friday said it has successfully executed the seizure order and confiscated the cargo from all four vessels, which totaled approximately 1,116,000 barrels of petroleum. The Justice Department credited the success to the U.S. government, but also the assistance of foreign partners in seizing that property. Infectious disease experts Mr. Fauci says it'll be safe to cast ballots in person if voters follow social distancing guidelines. National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease Director Anthony Fauci, doctor, said this week there is no reason Americans can't vote in person for the 2020 presidential election so long as voters follow proper social distancing guidelines with the coronavirus pandemic. I think if carefully done according to the guidelines, there's no reason that I can see why that cannot be the case. He was speaking to ABC News this week. If you go and wear a mask, if you observe the physical distancing and don't have a crowded situation, there's no reason we shouldn't be able to do that. Fauci added that individuals who are compromised with their physical health or otherwise and who are not interested in physically going to the polls on Election Day can use mail-in or absentee ballots. Now, those have to be requested as opposed to mail-in ballots that are just sent out to any and everyone. Well, apps warning about exposure to the novel coronavirus are being launched in three more states, Alabama, North Dakota, Wyoming. They're the latest states in the U.S. to warn users about potential exposure to COVID-19 by tracking their encounters through an app on their phone. That's according to Reuters. Virginia was the first to implement the app that was developed by Apple and Google, the outlet reported. So keep your eyes and ears open. That's very likely to be available to us at some point in the not-too-distant future. Well, the Mosier Creek fire has burned 971 acres and is about 10% contained. About 564 homes are threatened by the wildfire in the state of Oregon. On this day in history, 1945, President Harry S. Truman announces Imperial Japan surrendered unconditionally, ending World War II. 1935, the Social Security Administration becomes law, or the Act. 1947, Pakistan becomes independent of British rule. On this day in history, 1997, Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh is sentenced to death. 2003, a huge blackout hits the northeastern United States and parts of Canada. 50 million people lose power. Finally, on this day in history, 2008, President George W. Bush signs consumer safety legislation that bans lead from children's toys, imposing the toughest standard in the world. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, we'll hear my interview with Robert J. Hutchinson, The Death of Hitler, What Really Happened. My interview of the week. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Now, I don't know about you, but I love a great history mystery. And my next guest has started a series simply titled What Really Happened. And today we're going to take a look at one of those mysteries. We did the same back in April when he joins us to talk about what happened in the Lincoln assassination. But today we're going to be talking about whether or not Adolf Hitler died in his bunker, or whether he didn't. Well, award-winning pop history author Robert Hutchinson, he takes a new look at the case and he explores what really happened to Adolf Hitler in the second of his What Really Happened series, What Really Happened, The Death of Hitler. Well, according to official accounts and numerous eyewitnesses, the dictator of the Third Reich shot himself. Loyal Nazis burned his body, and the bones were removed by the Russians. Yet, after World War II, some 50% of Americans polled didn't believe the captured Nazis, who said that Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun had committed suicide in their Berlin bunker, were telling the truth. They thought the Führer had faked his death and escaped justice. Joseph Stalin himself told Allied leaders that Soviet forces never discovered his body and that he believed the Nazi leader had gotten away. There were numerous reports of top Nazi officials successfully fleeing to South America. Did Adolf Hitler do the same? Well, Robert Hutchinson is an award-winning writer, speaker, and author of numerous books of popular history, including What Really Happened, The Lincoln Assassination, When in Rome, and The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Bible. The general editor of the What Really Happened series, he gives talks on historical topics to groups throughout the country and Europe. He blogs at roberthutchinson.com, but today we're talking about his latest book, What Really Happened, The Death of Hitler. Hey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on again.
This is a great book to read this summer because you cover so much territory and so much of what we have known, what we think or thought we knew, and what we now assume about what happened to Adolf Hitler. Now, why was there such mystery around what actually happened to the man who instigated World War II?
Well, this is a story that's had a lot of legs. In other words, there's been a lot of things that have buttressed those people who say that Hitler likely got away over the decades. Just when things seem to quiet down, something seems to happen that gives new life to the story that Hitler might have escaped. I mean, it wasn't until as late as 2014 that Barack Obama authorized the release of formerly top secret FBI and CIA files that revealed that the FBI itself was investigating whether Hitler escaped well into the 1950s. So that gave kind of new life to the story. And then in 2009, the Russians finally allowed a U.S. pathology team to examine a skull fragment that they said was Hitler's. It had a bullet hole in it. And the U.S. expert said, based on DNA analysis and other tests, it could not have been Hitler's. It was a skull of a woman under the age of 40. So that set headlines all over the world. Maybe Hitler didn't die in the bunker after all. Maybe the history books got it wrong and so on. And then in 2015, the History Channel did a 3-year reality TV show dedicated to exploring this topic and taking it very, very seriously. So this has just been a story that kind of cries out to really settle it once and for all and determine what really happened.
Has it been settled once and for all? I'm not going to ask you to give a definitive yes, I know, or but has it been resolved at this point?
Yes. 2 years ago, it was resolved. In 2018, for the first time ever, scientific definitive tests were performed that let us know for certain what actually happened to Adolf Hitler in the years after World War. Up to that point, there really had only, there had been no body discovered, as far as the West was concerned, at least. And there were lots of holes in the official account that conspiracy theorists and authors and so on were able to point to at least give doubt to the official account. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were two submarines, Nazi submarines, that visited the coast of Argentina in July 1945. We have pictures of them. We know all about them. There were planes that took off right at the last minute going down. I was in Berlin researching this, and the big boulevard in the middle of the Tiergarten Park in central Berlin was used as a runway, and famous Nazi test pilots were able to escape at the last minute. And we know that Hans Bauer, Hitler's private pilot, had a long range aircraft standing by to whisk him away. And all of his associates were begging him to please escape. So we know all this stuff, and that has given credence to this story over the years, and that's what makes it so fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's go back and talk about the original story about Hitler's death. What was the story that was given at the time that most people didn't believe at the time, but was the official story about how Hitler died, if in fact Hitler died?
Well, what most people don't realize is that the Western Allies, the U.S. Army and so on, didn't come into Berlin for 2 months after the end of the war. The Russians were allowed to conquer Berlin. It was agreed at the Yalta Conference that they were to get that quote-unquote honor, and that's what they did. So there was no body. And there were all these, the Russians were saying different things to different people, and so the Western Allies basically appointed a Oxford historian named Hugh Trevor Roper to do a definitive report, and he was able to interview some of the witnesses, but not all of them. And he, based on what they said, he wrote the official report, the story we all know from the 2004 German story, German film Downfall, that Adolf Hitler married his longtime mistress, Eva Braun, in a brief civil ceremony, and then they retired to their inner room, and Hitler shot himself, and Eva Braun likely swallowed a cyanide capsule. And then, as you said, their aides took their bodies up to the garden of the Führerbunker and put them in a trench, poured dozens of gallons of gasoline on them, lit them on fire. And that was the last anyone knew of what happened to their bodies, according to Hugh Trevor Roper and the official accounts. And that remained the case for about 30 years. Nobody knew what happened. It wasn't until the late 60s and early 70s that the Russians finally admitted that, yeah, they actually did probably find Hitler's remains after all. So, but they never provided any proof one way or the other. And that's why the story has continued, is because the Russians were very tight-lipped about it, about what really happened. But we now know what actually happened was they recovered the remains of Hitler and Eva Braun and the Goebbels family. They performed a cursory autopsy, not very thorough, and they buried them in a secret location where they stayed for 25 years in Magdeburg, Germany.
Have those remains ever been recovered?
Well, no. What happened was in 1970, see, it's a very murky story. The chain
yes.
of events are, in 1970, the Soviets agreed to give back Germany to the East Germans. They were mm-hmm. basically an occupying army up to that point. And they were afraid that their secret would come out and that enterprising Germans would find the secret burial place of Hitler. And it would become a Nazi shrine, the way Lenin's tomb is a shrine for the communists. So they ordered Andropov, who was then the head of security, later became a Russian premier, ordered mm-hmm. that the bodies be dug up, disinterred from their secret location, re-incinerated again, and the dust be scattered in a river in East Germany, which is what happened. And the people that did that have spoken on the record about how they did that. There were two officers did it. But they kept two things. They kept the skull fragment I told you about earlier that they thought was Hitler's, and they kept his jawbone with his teeth in it. And it was Hitler's teeth that allowed for finally a positive identification that it was Adolf Hitler. If his teeth were in Moscow, then it was impossible that he escaped to Argentina. And in 2018, for the very first time ever, the Russians allowed a French forensic team to examine Hitler's teeth. And this team said with absolute certainty they were Hitler's teeth. because wow. of many factors. But the one reason they could positively identify him, they did have dental records that were, however, drawn from memory from Hitler's dentist, because his actual dental records disappeared in a plane crash in 1945, another mysterious coincidence. But they also had in the possession of the U.S. intelligence x-rays of Hitler's skull that were taken after the July 1944 assassination attempt, and those x-rays matched exactly the jawbone. So that allowed them to make a positive identification.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll continue our conversation. Again, we're talking with Robert Hutchinson, who is entered his second edition in the What Really Happened series, The Death of Hitler. This is the second in that series. A great read if you'd like to have some understanding of what we know, what we thought we knew, and what we've now confirmed. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. I'm continuing my conversation with Robert Hutchinson, his latest book, What Really Happened, The Death of Hitler. This has been a mystery unresolved for many, many years, as we all know. And this is a look at the evidence and what's happened over the decades following the declaration that he and Eva Braun committed suicide, with definitive answers. Now, we know that Hitler had had used body doubles. Could he have used one in the bunker while he and Eva Braun escaped? Could the x-ray that you made reference to have been someone other than himself?
Of course. Yes, they could have used that. Seriously, that's actually all of these things. You're talking about possibility, probability, plausibility, and all of these things are inherently possible and in some cases even plausible. And yes, Hitler did have occasionally used body doubles. The Russians, right after they arrived at the bunker on May 3rd, they found a body that kind of had a little Hitler mustache, and they thought, with a bullet hole right between his eyes, and they thought that it might have been Hitler's body double, but they were able to rule it out. There were some Russians who had actually met Hitler and said, no, that's definitely not him. But yes, they could have done that. The conspiracy theorists say that's exactly what happened, that the top Hitler aides swapped out a body double of Hitler and an actress who worked for Goebbels as Eva Braun. The real Hitler and Eva Braun escaped in a plane, and the fake Hitler and Eva Braun retired to Hitler's inner room, where they thought they were just going to have a nice lunch, and were shot dead by a Gestapo officer, and then those bodies were burned. And those were the bodies that the eyewitnesses saw. So that's the story that the conspiracy theorists say. Mm. Unfortunately, their evidence for that is practically non-existent. They have one facial identification expert that they rely upon, who says that photographs of Hitler could not have been Hitler at a certain point in the final week of his life and so on. But those photos are so murky anyway, that it's a pretty big stretch to accept that. And that's their only evidence. And the fact is, if you actually read some of these books, like Grey Wolf and others that say that Hitler escaped, they really have no evidence at all. Mm-hmm. Most of their books are talk about these plausibilities. Were there pilots who could have flown Hitler out of there? Yes. Were there submarines? Yes. Was there secret Nazi gold that could have supported Hitler in his getaway? Yes. They don't actually get around, though, to showing you any evidence really that he actually did it. Most of the books are just discussing these kind of other circumstances that make it possible, but that's not the same thing as being true.
Yeah.
And so
what anyway. Are some of the other major myths surrounding his death?
Well, you know, the big myths for me are less about his, well, some of the things that have amazed me studying this is how the role the media played in keeping this alive. One of the reasons people believe this is there were literally thousands of articles that had sightings of Hitler in the tabloid press and so on. And that kept this story alive for a long time, that Hitler was able to escape and live in Argentina. There were photographs, you know, people, you know, there were cover stories in magazines that had Hitler on them that said, did Hitler live in Buenos Aires and so on. What I really learned from this research was less about Hitler's death than about his life, about how he was able to take total control of a nation so quickly And that's what kind of surprised me, that I learned I hadn't really realized. I mean, I knew that Hitler was democratically elected and that he played by the rules in that sense, but I didn't really understand how he set the groundwork for that and how the government institutions in Germany relinquished their responsibility and basically handed power over to him legally. It was all done legally. Everything the Nazis did at first was done, quote unquote, legally through the passing of laws and so on due to an emergency. They thought that they were under attack. The Reichstag, which is their parliament building, the equivalent to our Congress, was burned in a big fire. And a communist guy was arrested. And so there was a lot of fear that a communist coup might be in the offing and so on. And again, it was plausible. They had seen what had happened in Russia, the German people, and they knew that the Russians had shot tens of thousands of people to effect their revolution. And they didn't want that. And so the German institutions and government and parliament and so on relinquished power and gave up their civil liberties in a quote-unquote temporary way, and Hitler used that to seize complete, total control. And that surprised me. I mean, I knew it a little bit, but I didn't know the details of it, and that was what I was really shocked by.
Yeah. Well, this story certainly has captured the imagination of the world over, because the thought of Adolf Hitler escaping justice is just more than I think most people could have taken at that time, and even up to the present. What happened to the last minute plans to fly Hitler and Eva Braun out of Berlin? Why wouldn't they have, and this is speculative, I suppose, why wouldn't they have availed themselves of that option rather than to end their lives as we now know they did?
Hitler didn't want to go. I mean, he was quite clear. I mean, as far as we can know with certitude in history, in his last will and testament, he announced that he was planned on ending his life. In the two documents, his political testament and his personal will, he stated that that was his intention. He told all of his aides that was his intention. We have the memoirs of all of the survivors of the Führerbunker who said he said that repeatedly. We have their accounts of like Magda Goebbels, the wife of Joseph Goebbels, literally begging Hitler on his knees to escape because she felt that was the only way she and her children could live, is if he lived. Otherwise, she knew that her husband intended on them all committing suicide if Hitler died. So she was literally begging him right at the last minute, actually, if you've seen that 2004 film Downfall.
Yes.
Right at the last minute, as they're closing the door, she comes in and begs Hitler to escape. And he adamantly refused because he thought he'd be caught anyway and that he would stand trial and be humiliated the way Mussolini was humiliated. And he had no intention of doing that. So that's why I think it's certain that he actually did kill himself, even though everybody wanted to escape. So that part of the conspiracy theory books is true. They did want him to escape.
But he himself had other plans. Yeah.
And
why do you think?
I say in my book, oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, what I say in my, you know, there were 40 attempts to kill Adolf Hitler, 40 documented attempts. And some of them came really close to blowing him to bits, as we know, from Operation Valkyrie and so on. But his erratic schedule always foiled them. And in the end, what all of his generals and all these conspirators failed to do, in a sense, Hitler did himself, which is kill himself. And the moment he did, the war stopped, the killing stopped. So, the moment he died was when World War II ended, at least in Europe. And, it's just, The last, say, 6 months, 9 months of the war is when much of the death toll actually occurred. So it's kind of a tragedy that if Hitler had done this earlier, he might have spared millions of people from dying.
Why do you think this story still resonates? Obviously, Adolf Hitler was such a tyrant. He was responsible for so much killing in the prosecution of the war, as well as in its his solution to eliminate the world of the Jewish community. Why do you think people still have so much interest in this story and certainly of resolving what happened to Adolf Hitler at the end of the war?
Well, because he continues to fascinate the world, because this ordinary man, and he was a very ordinary man in many ways, how this ordinary man who never achieved more than the rank of corporal in the army, and he was basically a high school dropout who basically starved on the streets of Vienna as he sold his watercolor postcards, and he failed at pretty much everything he ever did, yet he was able to take control of one of the most sophisticated countries on earth in a very short period of time, and then conquer all of Europe in a very, within in 10 years. So that fascinates people. And so how he was able to do it fascinates people. What kind of a person he was that could do that. And then, how he died and did he escape? It just kind of naturally lends itself to tabloid material. And it's just, Hitler books always sell well for some strange reason.
Yeah. And I think it's also a cautionary tale, what to avoid in the future, to try to learn from history to prevent this from happening again.
Yes. I've said this over and over on my book tour, is that if I learned anything from this research and going to Germany and studying this period, some European recently said that Americans treat democracy like a football they can kick around, and it should be treated like a Fabergé egg, their most precious possession. It should be treated delicately and not easily bruised or whatever. And that's what the lesson of Hitler actually is that democracy is a very fragile thing, and you can lose it in a heartbeat. At least in Germany, as I said, he used the democratic process to eliminate democracy. And so we should all be on guard.
Absolutely.
For that. You don't give up your civil rights, your civil liberties easily.
Without the forensic capacity that we have today, could there be a definitive answer as to whether or not Adolf Hitler ended his life at the end of World War II?
It depends on what degree of certitude you want. They had photographs of his teeth that were released earlier, and old-fashioned dentists going on the dental records were able to make it a decision on that it was Hitler's teeth. What was different in 2018 was they were actually able to do physically examine with an electron microscope the actual teeth themselves. Before that, the Russians had only released photographs. So you had photographs, and then you had remembered dental records from Hitler's dentist and the dental technician who made his bridge work. And so, that's what they used to say that those were probably Hitler's teeth. But, what degree of certitude is that? So it just depends on – history is not like math.
That's
right. You
don't
have absolute certitude.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
only have degrees of probability.
Now, I have to ask you, if you're willing to divulge the information, what's next in the What Really Happened series?
We have a whole bunch of titles that we've been batting around. We've got to narrow down to a couple. We want to handle the problem is I want to be able to solve things. So, for example, Amelia Earhart, whatever happened, what really happened to Amelia Earhart, things like that. I want to be able to give a definitive answer, at least within a reasonable degree of certitude. Same thing with JFK, things like that. So the topics that we're choosing have to be mysteries that have a lot of controversy surrounding them, but also ones that now, after the passage of time, we think we have actually solved it. And so that eliminates a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It also leaves for a lot of things, but it also eliminates things. Like, I wouldn't want to take on JFK at this point. Amelia
no.
Earhart, Amelia Earhart, I'm closer to.
Well, we will certainly wait with great interest for the next in the series. Robert Hutchinson, thank you so much for joining us once again. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me on again.
Thank you. Again, the book is So What Really Happened, The Death of Hitler. It's published by Regnery History, a great read, especially during the summertime, or if you find, like most of us, you have a little extra time for reading. Covers not just what happened at the end of his life, but as Mr. Hutchinson pointed out, some of the events that led to his prominence and as a leader and so on.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgene Rice Show. Well, a children-sized playhouse was listed on Airbnb as a joke in Ludgershall, England. Then a family actually booked it for a weekend for about $653, or I should say pounds and 35, whatever their smaller currency is, according to the current exchange rate. Well, this was put together by a 49-year-old man named Jason King, who built the 8-foot by 6-foot playhouse in his garden during the coronavirus shutdown. It was just for fun. We listed it as a space for a laugh, he told the local news outlet. We put that price on there and thought nobody would be interested. However, a family did submit an inquiry last weekend for the balcony-equipped structure that's modeled on a Lottie doll treehouse. It's a famous toy in the UK, which also happens to be one of his children's favorites. Other playhouse amenities include a slide, a ladder, a trapdoor, bunk beds, and Wi-Fi. A short distance away is a Doctor Who bathroom that's a replica of the sci-fi TV show's TARDIS time machine. The father of five said it cost about $4,572 to put together the building, which he completed after a few weeks. The family hasn't backed out of their booking either, and they're reportedly following through on their stay. That starts tomorrow. We're making pizza and sorting out breakfast at the moment. I think it's amazing and insane, the owner says, while adding that the family will be provided access to their pool as well. I'm not sure I would pay that much for my kids to stay in one, but the fact that someone's going to do that is pretty incredible, he said. We're going to keep listing it. If we get a few of these, well, it will pay for itself. So I think the TARDIS bathroom might have been appealing to you, James.
Absolutely. Where is this again?
This is in England, so you'd have to.
Oh, that's a little bit of a hoof. It's a little bit of a hoof, but
Ludgershall.
Hey, why not? There's a there's always a good opportunity to express my geekery, as it were.
Well, if you want to go a little bit closer to home, the world's last Blockbuster video store has listed on Airbnb. This is the world's last Blockbuster. It's right here in Oregon. It's being listed there for a series of 1990s themes movie sleepover parties. Sandy Harding, who's been the store manager for about 20-year-old store, I should say, since 2004, listed the Blockbuster in Bend on the accommodation finding site for up to 4 people to stay on 3 available dates in September. She had a living room set up inside the store, complete with a large 1990s era television and VCR and a plethora of tapes, as you can imagine. In our 20th year as a Blockbuster, we were hoping to celebrate that this year, but with COVID throwing a wrench into everybody's plans, we were really excited to be able to pull this off. She was speaking on CNN. She said the Airbnb listing is a way to give back to the community, although you have to pay, that has kept the video store in business while all the other Blockbusters have gone bust. It's only $4 for the night, a penny more than what you would spend for a new release, she said. So the world's last Blockbuster video store, you can hire that out in September for an overnight. And a Minnesota man sold the 1957 Chevy pickup he drove for 44 years, and he's selling it for the same price he paid for it decades ago, $75. Bob Sportall of Prinesburg, he handed over the key last month to the grandson of the man who bought the truck from him. Sportall was in his early 20s when he bought the rusty pickup truck from a retiring farmer. He drove that truck to work every day at a local grain elevator until he retired some 5 years ago. Sportall kept driving the truck but decided to sell it to Tom Leenstra, the grandson of the late John Vanderveen, who originally sold the truck to him. It's like riding with my grandpa again, Leenstra says. The truck has taken an antique value, but Sportall decided to sell it for what he paid for it. It's going in the family, so that's the most important thing. So handed down a 1957 Chevy to the grandson of the man who originally sold it to its last owner. Well, a Minnesota woman's unusual talent made her a Guinness World Record holder when she spelled 56 words backward in a minute. Pal Onan of Hastings said she wanted to attempt the record to put her town on the map. So it's now apparently on the map, Hastings. Guinness shared video of Onan quickly spelling 56 words backward from a randomized list in 1 minute time limit. The video also featured Onan showing off another of her talents, pronouncing words backward. Now, I have enough trouble pronouncing them the right way, but trying to do all of that backward, it's, I guess, pretty impressive. The research highlights the demands of storing vast quantities of digital data, and they've determined that digital content will be half the Earth's mass by 2245 as information catastrophe looms. There'll be so much of it, it's going to occupy half of the Earth's mass, they say. Now, 2245, is it still going to be here going on? Oh, come quickly, Lord Jesus. Digital content is on track to equal half the Earth's mass by 2245, according to new research. Dr. Melvin Vopson, he's a senior lecturer at the UK's University of Portsmouth. He highlights the physics of information creation and the demands of storing vast quantities of digital data. Now, to us, it just seems to be off in the ether, but it actually has to go someplace. Well, the physicist says, assuming the current growth trend in digital content, if it continues, the world will reach a singularity point in terms of the maximum digital information possibly created and the power needs to sustain it, called the information catastrophe. He writes in a paper published by AIP Advances, the Journal of the American Institute of Physics. The information catastrophe will add to existing global challenges such as climate, environment, population, food, health, energy, and security, according to the researcher. Now, the study examines the incredible growth of digital bits, the unit used to measure computer data. Now, in the singularity point, more digital bits will be created than atoms on the planet. At the same time, the digital information production alone will consume most of the planetary power capacity, he writes. Well, with current data storage densities, the number of bits produced per year and the size of a bit compared to the size of an atom, at a rate of 50% annual growth, the number of bits would equal the number of atoms on Earth in approximately 150 years, according to the press release on the research. Well, Dr. Vopson says it would be approximately 130 years until the power needed to sustain digital information creation would equal all the power currently produced on our planet. By 2245, the research says, half of the Earth's mass would be digital information mass. Now, you might need to be a bit geeky, but I find that absolutely fascinating. It's not just dissipating into the ether. Things have to be stored someplace.
Nothing ever goes away.
That's true. In closing, I wanted to mention that the popular Columbia River Gorge tourist spots are reopening. From Multnomah Falls to several scenic hiking paths, the gorge is back in business, but it is certainly a different looking business. It's a breathtaking sight that was not able to be seen by visitors for months. But this week, Horsetail Falls reopened. It's one of many sites in the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area that reopened this week with the reopening of the historic Columbia River Highway. And while drivers are free to cruise the scenic highway, stopping along it might be a bit challenging. Some of the parking lots are still closed, including the one at Multnomah Falls. That scenic area reopened to limited visitors on Tuesday. You can't stop at Multnomah Falls. You can drive by and wave and take a selfie out the window or something like that, but there's no parking at Multnomah Falls except for the I-84 parking lot, the Oregon Department of Transportation explained. Now, if you want to go, check out which ones are open. Be prepared to just do a drive-by, but you can now at least see them as you pass by and wave. James Blind is the producer of today's program, Clark Hilton Engineering, Dan Rice. He's given the use of his office. Thank you, gentlemen. And thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great weekend. Pray for revival. And join us again on Monday right here on the Georgine Rice Show.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show. And like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.